Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which brews beers that are highly rated by beer critics and beer lovers alike. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Codd, and my partner is Jim DeRogatis. This week, we're talking with Jack White.
A few years ago, Greg and I took a road trip down to Nashville to interview Jack in his amazing recording studio and record store. We talked with him about his life growing up in Detroit, the beginning and the end of his most famous band, the White Stripes, and his record label, Third Man Records. It was such an amazing interview. We're revisiting it today. When we talked to Jack in 2012, I started by asking how music first came into his life.
Yeah, my older brothers all played instruments, so, you know, they had a band going, and a cousin who lived on the street also played, like, clarinet, fiddle, electric guitar as well. So the attic where they all slept, because there's a lot of kids in the, you know, there's like three of them slept up there, I think, at the time when I was maybe like 5 years old, but there was a drum kit up there, you know, all kinds of pawn shop guitars and stuff. It was second nature to play any of those instruments, but I loved playing the drums from early on. I liked, you know, did recordings with them when I was like 4 or 5 years old, and always played, the whole time I was growing up, just did nothing but play the drums. I played other instruments a little bit, like guitar a little bit or whatever, but didn't really care about it.
What was the scene like in Detroit? Did you feel like there was bands to play in? There were role models for you as a guy to be playing in bands? How did that all start, that you took that next step to actually going out and playing shows?
There was a lot of huge Catholic families, even on that block. There's probably like 4 or 5 big Catholic families just on that block. And the next door neighbors, the Muldoons, who I ended up working at Brian Muldoon's upholstery shop when I got to be a teenager. Maybe they were into like more punk rock and more heavier stuff. They were into, or the MC5 and the Stooges kind of rock and roll, I think. And my brothers were more into The Who, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, Rolling Stones.
Say a prayer for the common foot soldier. Spare a heart for his back-breaking work.
There was a lot of that going on. I was always hanging out with people who were 20 years older than me. You know, even when I became a teenager, I became a songwriter, you know, as a later teenager, and went to coffee houses and Hamtramck and stuff. It was all these artists from Europe that were, you know, in their 40s when I was 18 or whatever. So all my mentors and role models were always way older.
And when I talked to you years ago, you were talking about these blues records that had this transformative power in your life.
Yeah.
And you were getting these from these older listeners, I take it, right?
Yeah, like when I worked at Muldoon's shop, his goal was to sort of turn me on to all these things I had never heard, which, you know, because when he started to realize the things I hadn't heard, it was sort of, he was kind of shocked or something, you know. So it would be like, while we were working one day, he'd play me the Velvet Underground, and the next day he'd play me the Cramps, the next day we'd listen to Fugazi. It was his goal to, as a mentor, to also turn me on to all this other music, which I'm very thankful for. You know, he took me to my first punk concert, which was Fugazi. On and on and on. We also had a 2-piece band together, me and him. So when we were done at the end of the day, we would move the couches and chairs over and start and set up and play. And he was a drummer, so I had to play guitar to play with him, which wasn't really that my big interest, you know. And I was like 15 years old. So I'm like, all right, I'll play guitar because he only plays drums. So if we're going to play together, that's...
I better learn this.
I guess I got to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. I had been doing that a little bit because I'd gotten a reel-to-reel 4-track, and so I wanted to record drums, but I had something to play along with, so I would play a guitar part and play the drums along with it. So that was what we had going on there, but it was just a perfunctory thing to play guitar. Mm-hmm. No, I had no interest in it until later on when I started thinking about writing songs.
Well, it's kind of neat that you had these people in your life who took the time to show you. I have a friend who's a sociology professor who writes a lot about music and says it's much like the drug culture. Like, nobody knows how to inhale or how to snort whatever until somebody's shown, right? Do you think it's the same today? You know, are people getting that same kick if they just accidentally download something or follow one of those website recommendations? If you like this, may like this.
I think that can happen slightly in certain instances. And I definitely stumbled onto things on accident here and there, but most of it was people putting something in front of my face. But I gotta say, the funny thing was, a lot of those records he'd play, I did not like them. And the same thing with the blues, you know, I said like, oh yeah, I like the blues, like whatever, it's okay, you know, and you know, I like rock and roll and I know all those guys play these all these blues songs from these old blues artists. It wasn't until Sun House where it really, really kicked in. Howlin' Wolf was sort of my gateway drug, you know. And I was like, yeah, Howlin' Wolf's great, you know, and learned how to play Sitting on Top of the World when I was like 14 or something like that. But then Sun House was later on, like 17 or something, like 17 or 18, maybe something like that. He just blew my mind in the way that you could always, the way I still to this day hope I can still find new things to blow my mind. But that was, that'll always be the most important to me.
Don't you mind people grinning in your face? Don't mind people grinning in your face. Yeah, just bear this in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face? You know your mother will talk about you.
A grinning in your face, that song in particular came up. What was it about that song that sort of transfixed you?
I think it just sort of says everything at once. It says everything about what it's like to be alive and to have situations and social interaction with other people. That no matter what you do, it's in a lot of ways, it's a lose-lose situation, so you should just get used to that idea. You can't live your life hoping for this scenario to occur that's never going to happen. He can say lines and songs, you know, like, ain't it hard to love somebody who don't love you? And that's really indicative of everything we think about all day long. And that song especially, that even your own mother will talk about you. That's pretty hardcore to say something like that in a song. And it's true, man. I mean, it's true for everybody.
You know they'll jump you up and down. They'll carry you all around and around. Just as soon as your back are turned, they'll be trying to crush you down. Yes, but bear this in mind, a true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face?
I don't even understand that idea, like grinning in your face is such a bizarre lyric to put. He could have said, don't you mind people talking about you or something, but don't you mind people grinning in your face? Now they're gonna smile at you and lie to you to your face. That's pretty heavy, man, you know. So I don't know, just it still to this day hits me like that.
What kills me about what you're saying is it wasn't just a sound, it was you were getting wisdom out of these records.
Yeah, exactly. You know, somebody said well, why did I like the blues or whatever, and it's like, because it's the truth. It's the only thing I can think of is to say that it's the truth. There's all the ideas of what people think the blues is, like the Blues Brothers or these, you know, glasses, or I woke up this morning, da 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 da, kind of. But the blues really, at its purest form, is the truth. And that's why I think all of the great music is built off of it, because it all has a taste of what the truth really is. At gunpoint, someone would pick up a guitar and say, play something for these people, you would probably play something that was very similar to what the blues is.
So you love this music, and you went back deep and went back to the source. And I got the sense, when I talked to you years ago, that the White Stripes weren't, in fact, they wanted to play this music. They loved it. They embraced it. But at the same time, it was kind of like there were almost a little sheepishness about it, because there's these two white kids from Detroit playing this music that is so deep, and there's so much wisdom in it.
Yeah.
Were you feeling a little bit like, we've got to attack this from our own angle, otherwise people are just going to laugh us off the stage?
Kind of very much so. It was, especially in that hipster garage rock world, that blues is already a dangerous territory to even think about performing it, you know, because there's all that horrible Stratocaster blues that everyone's gotten so dulled down by. So you had to almost like have some kind of pretension to it, like a tongue-in-cheek thing, which I saw certain bands kind of doing that kind of stuff. But to me, it was like I don't like that. I didn't like the humor involved in the blues, which there was a lot of humor-based blues bands at that time too, which totally turned me off. What I was also interested at the same time was design, and a lot of things, just breaking something down to its simplistic form. I was thinking about starting to design furniture and stuff. And when Meg sat down on the drums and we played, I was trying to play simply. And it ended up sounding so much more powerful than any other bands I'd played with, other people I'd played with, and we kept going. But I said, there's something going on here, and it's going to take a second, but let's just keep trying it.
When the seven
by the way, the aesthetic of the band kind of came from these natural things, like her liking peppermint candies, and we painted peppermint candy in her bass drum. I said, well, we should play like kids, and she had two ponytails and all that stuff. And this, there's a childishness to simplicity. Let's focus on this. You're playing like a little kid. I'll play like a little kid too, but we'll interject all of this, and this will all be the blues. And nobody will know it's the blues because it'll have all this stuff around it. It'll be harder to decipher, and maybe we'll get somewhere. Then we see we're going to play our first couple shows at the Gold Dollar in the corridor, and we kind of thought, people aren't going to like this, and makes like people aren't going to get this. They're just going to think I'm not a good drummer, Jack, and stuff. And like, people really liked the band instantly, which was pretty shocking. I mean, for as jaded as all those hipsters are, man, they kind of immediately gave us a chance. It was such a bizarre little band. It's the kind of band you would want to go see if you were on tour somewhere and you stopped in a bar, and this is the kind of band I would wish to see or find a record in a record rack. And that's how I started attacking those Italy records when we were recording those first Italy records, 45s. It was like, well, let's make this record as if, you know, if you were searching through and you pulled this out and you found this strange record and you put it on, wouldn't it be great if it was also at good?
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. I'm with Greg Codd, and we're talking to Jack White. Jack, you used the word hipster a couple times. It seems like you're getting something off your chest. Hipster and this notion of authenticity. Yeah. You seem to have been happy to be liberated lately. I'm not going to care about that crap anymore.
Mm-hmm.
These indie rock hipsters who say, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Mm-hmm. If you're going to play blues, you better sneer at it or be sarcastic or irony and blah, 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 blah. All right, explain that bug up your butt.
Yeah. Well, anytime you're in a kind of scene of music, there is these parameters that you're probably not allowed to leave if you want to exist in that world. I'm sure if you're a country singer here in Nashville, you've got one format at radio, country, not nine different versions of country. There's country, that's it. And if you don't record in a certain way, you're not going to get played on the radio. So every genre has their things, has their rules, and has their, like, you know, if you step outside of it, people are going to look at you cross-eyed. But the worst is white, hip, you know, jaded, garage rock, whatever that world is. That's the harshest, I think, because you kind of can't win. There's so much pretension on every side of you. It's not supportive. It's not supportive. So what you get, like, say, what I would be jealous of back then is, like, you know, say, like, the country we're right now, they're very loyal fans. Like, if you start liking Garth Brooks or Faith Hill, you're going to like them till the day you die. In rock and roll, they might like you this week, but next month, man, I don't know. Like, I remember when we came out with the second White Stripes record, the second album. I mean, still, nobody give a damn about us. I remember people saying, oh, there's a band that went bad really fast. It was like, damn, man. You know, it was like, the funny thing is they're the most open-minded people to thinking about what can be considered art. But it gets wrapped around authenticity, which is the biggest bunk ever. You know, authenticity is just an evil trap. And we've always had fun messing with it. I mean, the very fact with the White Stripes, to go out on stage and everything's red, white, and black is so completely inauthentic. Obviously, those are not your street clothes, and obviously, you know, it was a big, like, haha, isn't that, is it exactly what you hate? You know, but it was twisted on itself so much that you couldn't, I think a lot of them couldn't help but like it.
But you decided
you can keep going and
that.
Going.
I'm
going to
play with this.
I always have. I mean, the first 45 White Stripes, we did a Marlena Dietrich song on the B-side. I mean, that's like obviously something a blues band wouldn't do.
Me over closely. Tell me what you see.
After a short break, more of our interview with Jack White. And later, a history of the Rickenbacker 12-string guitar in rock. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
That makes the evening sun go down. Oh,